702. Political analysis.
Tessa Dooms is my guest and she joins me on the telephone. She's director of programs at the Rivonia Circle. Tessa, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. I really, really appreciate your time.
No, it's good to be here. Election season, so the more we talk to each other, especially voter to voter, the better.
Absolutely. I think in my lifetime, I never thought I'd get to a place where I'd see a sub 50% for the African National Congress, given the unassailable political position that it had until not so long ago, right? But it appears that post the 29th of May, we may see an ANC that is below the 50% mark. Does this necessarily mean that we're going to have a government of national unity, a form of a coalition?
Yeah, so there is a difference between a government and of national unity and a coalition in the sense that the government of national unity was a coalition that was formed even though the ANC had enough to form a government by themselves. It was an arrangement that was made, and that's why it was called a government of national unity. And so unlike that moment, I don't think we're going to see anything similar to that right now. I mean, you made reference to the Moonshot Pact.
Yeah.
And even that is a loose arrangement of parties that may work together in a coalition after the election, but that's also subject to the vote. And that's the first place to start with a coalition conversation. Some people say, you know, are we ready for coalitions? Are we not ready? We don't get to vote for a coalition or against a coalition. The votes and the outcome of the votes as they are determines whether a coalition is necessary. And so a coalition is an outcome of our vote rather than something that we vote for or vote against. And so our job and the job of everybody participating in this election, including the political parties, is to prepare for any eventuality. It is also true that because we are in a multi-party democratic system and our constitution calls for proportionality and multi-party outcomes, we actually should have been anticipating this a long time ago. So we don't have a winner-takes-all system like you have in the U.S., for example, with the president. You know, you have a winner-takes-all type of system. We don't have that kind of system in South Africa. And so actually the anomaly is having one-party dominance. So we should have been a lot more prepared for this outcome or this kind of outcome a long time ago. But again, it's the voters that will decide. So, I mean, all the predictions are out there. But those predictions are also based on the known voter pool, you know, they're not based on new voters. They're not based even on voters that have retreated from the voting process, which is a lot of people. But the more people show up, the less predictable the election will be. And that's the reason why parties are saying, well, we must start thinking about the possibility of a coalition.
What is the prognosis? I mean, what do we think is going to happen? Are we going to have an unprecedented voter turnout? Or are we going to have a situation like we had, I think, was it in 2019, where there was a very, very low voter turnout because a lot of people didn't feel like they're going to see any difference in the political scenario?
Yeah, I think where we saw the depressed voter turnout was actually 2021. And that was for a variety of reasons, including a much shorter runway up into the elections. But I think that the possibilities of a higher voter turnout are there this year because there's a lot of political contestation. And so people are seeing a lot more options. We know that we have over 50 options on the ballot. The election ballot was formalized today. So there'll be just over 50 on the national ballot. We'll also now have independent candidates on regional ballots. There'll be three ballots this year. And on the provincial ballots will also be some independent candidates. And so I think that there's a higher level of contestation and that should bring out more voters. But also we have 2 months here, just under 2 months. Get as many people of the 27.7 million who are registered to turn out to vote. And again, the message that I've been saying to voters is that if we want the outcome to not be predictable, you know, everybody's worried that there won't be change, it will be a predictable outcome. The thing that will make the outcome unpredictable and that would give the best opportunity for change and shaking up the political landscape and making sure the big parties and incumbent parties aren't just complacent is higher voter turnout. And that's not going to happen by the political party side, by the way. The political parties are only going to turn out people who they know will vote for them.
Yeah.
And so for the rest of us who are not political party members, who may not have made up our minds yet, we need to encourage each other to turn out to vote. Because no matter who you vote for, the more people vote, the harder the political parties have to work in order to get those votes and in order to get over the line.
Sure.
And I think that we underestimate the power of voters. You know, I always say if only five people showed up to vote and all five of them were politicians, they would still count for 100% of the voting population.
Mm.
So our job is to show up and to make sure that the political parties have to work for those seats rather than just get them because we stayed at home thinking we're punishing the parties when actually we're making it easier for them.
Part of the reason why we, in 1994, for example, saw such a huge voter turnout is because it was a watershed moment. The issues were very clear. It was the removal of an illegitimate NP government and replacing it with a government that is voted for by the people. The issues were broad, but they were clear. In 2021, I think maybe we underestimated the fact that the issues were not as clear as we would perhaps have wanted them to be as they had been in 1994. Do we know what the issues for which voters need to show up and vote for are at this point?
I mean, so I could tell you what I've seen in different surveys, but I think the answer is really that voters need to determine the issues for themselves. I think for too long as voters, we've passively sat back and waited to see what the political parties offer up.
Yeah.
And so at the Rivonia Circle, we are hosting what we call voter conversations, where we're saying to people, decide for yourself what's on the ballot for you. You are going to go and hire and fire people to go and work for you. You must give them a mandate. You must tell them what you care about and then measure their manifestos and their offerings against what you care about, not what they care about. And so we must be a lot more proactive about asking ourselves, what are the issues that we care about? When we did a survey about a year and a half ago, we did see the big issues that we saw from our survey were things like load shedding was big. Basic services, even though we're going into a national election, was a big issue. And infrastructure, we've heard that a lot as well in communities. Employment and unemployment. Not necessarily the top issue, but definitely one of the biggest issues. But again, those are things that come from the surveys pool. But voters don't need to listen to anyone else but themselves and their communities and the people who share their interests and need to decide. And the broader landscape of political parties is, you know, it's daunting. When we think about there are 50 parties on the ballot.
Yeah.
It does feel daunting, but it does also present opportunities, as do coalitions. And so the opportunity presents for the voter is, number one, you can find a single issue party that resonates with an issue you care about more than anything else. So there's a party called the Forum for Service Delivery. That party is going to look at service delivery issues and only focus on that. If that's where your interest is, even if you're not, you know, that party may not take the presidency. But having a representative from that party, if you care about service delivery in parliament, is a way into the conversation, is a way for somebody to go in there and champion your cause. And so I do think voters need to see this as an opportunity to find different representatives that can go and champion our causes. And Zaki Ahmed, who's one of the independent candidates, makes a very, very important point because he says, you know, as independent candidates, they're going in there knowing they're going to be parliamentarians and they're going to have one seat. But they also then have a higher burden on them to convince other parties and other MPs to vote with them on their issues. And that's the kind of work ethic we should also expect from our MPs. So the other thing is know who is on the ballot and who's going to go there and fight for you. Who, you know, the parties have put out their list. Look at those lists and see, are those the kind of people that you know will champion the issues you care about, that you can hold accountable? Because coalitions, actually, you know, all politics is coalition building. Even within parties, you have to convince each other of positions. And I think we mustn't be scared of coalitions because, in fact, it is the job of MPs to debate each other, to convince each other, and to coalesce around ideas on behalf of the voters.
You pointed out that we have about 2 months before we vote. And the ideal is for us to come out in our numbers and vote. But you also point out that we need to be a lot more conscious and a lot more proactive about how we interpret the political landscape and the issues that are going to make us come out in our numbers. Have we developed that culture sufficiently to have enough people have that kind of proactive relationship with the political representatives that want our votes?
No, I don't think we have. I don't think we've thought of ourselves as the employers that are going to hire and fire at the voting booth. So we've not been proactive. If anyone's ever run a business, you don't run the business and then expect the person who's going to work for you to come and run the interview on your behalf. And so we must take that kind of approach to it, but also know how the system works. So, for example, in the National Assembly in the 2019 election, it took about 40,000 votes in order to get a seat in Parliament. Mm. And so we must also start thinking about which collective am I part of, where I represent a seat in Parliament with other citizens and with other voters, that we can make a compelling case that our vote can actually get somebody a seat in Parliament. I mean, we can think about the wards that we live in. We can think about the interest groups that we are part of, people who are part of you know, communities who care about certain issues, communities who are fighting for the rights of LGBTQI plus people. What are your numbers, right? What are the numbers you have on your side with people who care about the things that you care about? And to put that in front of political parties and say, this is a seat that's on the table. Civil society is starting to organize itself that way. There's groups in the Western Cape who are organizing themselves around land and housing issues. And they're saying to politicians, we represent X number of communities and X number of voters who care about land and housing issues. Come and convince us that you also care about it. And I think that's the kind of approach we must take. We're calling it voter-to-voter conversations, where as voters, let us come together and see how can we form a pact amongst ourselves about what the ethics are behind our vote, what the issues are we care about, and what we're going to ask in return for our vote.
11883-0702. My guest is Director of Programs at the Rivonia Circle, Tessa Dworms. And encouraging us as voters to have conversations amongst each other. To develop, I suppose, a new voter culture, a new approach to our democracy that puts us at the forefront of the political conversation rather than the politicians who often tell us what the issues are. My question to you, have you thought about what the issues that you want to vote for? What are the issues that are going to make you show up on the 29th of May? 2024 was very, very racial in its issue base. It was about the fissures between the idea that there was an illegitimate white government and an incoming legitimate democratically elected black government. Fundamentally, the issues were hinged on issues of race. That seems to be dying out. I know that there are political parties who, in one way or the other, try to rehash that kind of thing because, you know, it's shown dividends at some point in the electoral process. But it seems to be dying out. People are looking for different things. As you've said, that there are people that are focused on LGBTIQ community issues. Some people are interested in issues of service delivery, some issues. So the politics are no longer deeply ideological, if that makes any sense, Tessa. They're no longer about socialism or communism and capitalism and those kinds of things, or at least they're not articulated in that way. I want to ask, I suppose it's a similar question in a broader way. What are the issues? What do they look like? And how do people then get a sense of coalescing around broad issues that would represent what they feel about?
Yeah, so I think that the best way to think about this is that South Africans actually do care about ideas, right? And we do care about ideology, not necessarily in those compartmentalized ways.
Yeah.
But in the engagements that we have with voters, there are two things that stand out. One is the question of accountability. And we hear voters say this all the time. How do we know that people will be accountable? And part of the offering that political parties need to give to those voters who care about accountability is, how will we hold you accountable once you're in parliament?
Yeah.
How will we know that you're going to do what you say you're going to do? I think accountability is on the ballot in this election in a really, really fundamental way. The second one is just an understanding of the role of the state and how government plays a role in the personal lives of people, right? I think that in previous elections, it hasn't been as stark that people can feel the impact of politics in their daily lives. So water issues in Gauteng are a really good example of this, where you know and you understand that a political decision by politicians is affecting my ability to, you know, have water in my house. And so there's a very personal sense that the are on the ballot. And the fact that politics and political decisions have very personal consequences. And I think voters want to know that politicians understand that, and that politicians are not going to just walk off into the sunset and think they can do this by themselves. I've said to people, I think that South Africa, we are the closest we've possibly been to what I call Trump's America. And Trump's America was a very simple thing. Donald Trump came out and said, the establishment politics and people who are, you know, in political spaces, they are elites. They don't care about you. They're doing their own thing there. And your lives are falling apart here. And I can see it. So I'm going to go and fight that demon for you. I'm going to go and fight the establishment for you. And that's how Donald Trump got people riled up. Not because he's offering, it was very specific about how he's going to fix the water issue.
Yeah.
But because he was hitting a sentiment where people feel excluded from politics. They feel like the politicians are not doing it for them. And I think that that's, again, an ideological issue around governance and how governance works in the country. People really care about making sure that they are included in the process. I think democracy is on the ballot in some ways, and parties need to be listening, because, you know, everybody's going to have to deal with everything because there's so many crises.
Yeah.
There's not a party that's not going to talk about crime anymore. But it's how they're going to do it that people care about, not what they're going to do.
And are people asking those questions in the way that is going to give them the information as to who to vote for? I'll tell you what my little pet peeve is, my little frustration is that particularly the parties in the opposition, in other words, non-ANC parties, it sounds to me, and I know that if I go a little bit closer and dig a little deeper, it does get, you do get more detail, but the sound that comes from the political parties that are not ANC is that vote for us because we are not ANC.
Yeah.
And I understand that embedded in that is the idea and the ideology of accountability. The ANC has messed up, therefore we want something else other than the ANC. But for me, it feels like that's not enough. It feels like, you know, sure, I get that, but you're telling me what I already know. You're not telling me anything else. And my sense is that is how many South Africans are feeling about the general political space, to say that, yeah, so the ANC has messed up and nobody can deny that, right? But the message from the political parties on the opposition can't simply be vote for me because I'm not ANC.
No, absolutely. And that's the reason why we're seeing a plethora of new parties, right? Because the opposition space, or the space of opposition politics, has been very narrow and hasn't had the nuance I think many voters have been looking for. So that's been one of the issues, the just anything but the ANC. But one of the things we found doing community engagements is the only thing that scares voters more than continuing the status quo is uncertainty about what comes next.
Yeah.
That's why we're so afraid of coalitions, by the way. We are uncertain of what that's going to look like. And even though, I mean, in the country at the moment, there are over 80 municipalities that are hung councils that either are operating as minority hung councils or have coalitions. But we focus on like the three or four that are failing, because that gives us the like this vivid picture of what failure could look like.
Yeah.
And so it's the uncertainty that political parties need to help with. And I think that's why smaller parties, especially these micro parties and local level communities, are doing or are getting anyone to respond to them, or independent candidates, because there's a certainty in knowing who that guy is, or knowing who that lady is, and knowing where she stays,
yep,
and knowing that I have an engagement with that person who's going to be my MP, that helps people out, but also being able to be clear and articulate what you're trying to do. Single issue parties can be very clear. There's a party called the Basic Income Grant South Africa Party, BIGSA. Yeah. I mean, anybody who votes for BIGSA knows exactly what BIGSA is offering. You don't have to be confused. And people like that sense of certainty. And so the offering is not just about saying we want the ANC gone. People want to know what happens next.
Yeah.
And so parties need to say, okay, this is the plan that we have going forward. This is how we're going to ensure accountability. This is how we're going to manage coalitions. Being able to answer that question before the election is important. Not necessarily who we'll go into coalition with, because the voters will give you the numbers. But you must at least say, these are the principles. These are the issues we will base around. This is the kind of parties that we will reject. These are the kind of parties we will accept. The more certainty people have that there's a party with a plan, the more they will gravitate towards that party.
One of the things you pointed out right at the beginning of the conversation was that the Government of National Unity of 1994 was an arrangement. An arrangement that really had nothing to do with the organic, spontaneous results of the votes. That's why we even had sunset sure. clauses and all of those kinds of things. It was an arrangement. Shouldn't we even be entertaining that at this point, Tessa? An arrangement that is going to provide South Africans with the kind of certainty that the current situation is not giving us at the moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's two ways to approach that, right? There's the multi-party charter moonshot pathway that says, here are the parties that we will have a coalition with, and this is our pre-election arrangement. Now, there are many things that we could say about why that may or may not be a good idea. But if you look at other places on the continent, in fact, where you've seen governments change hands on the continent has often been through pre-election coalitions and arrangements like that. Usually they work better when that coalition or arrangement is on the same ticket. So you'll see in Lesotho, we just had a change of government last year, where you had a new party come in and it consolidated a lot of small parties and was on one ticket in the ballot and got a high enough percentage to form a coalition with one other party. In Kenya, we've seen two election cycles where you've had what they call umbrella parties.
Yeah.
So a party that gets formed during the election that is an umbrella of various parties. Botswana has had the same. So that's one way of giving some sense of certainty. The other way is through a system and a process that is certain. And so last year, the Deputy President, Paul Mashatile, hosted political parties, a wide range of political parties, all of them in parliament and some not, for a coalition's indaba almost, to come up with the rules of engagement, to say, here's a framework for how we manage coalitions.
Yes.
And most countries in the world, and this is in fact true, are not countries that are dominated by one party or one president. Most are coalitions. In Western Europe, the majority of countries are coalition governments and have not had a single party majority for decades. The reason why it can work in those contexts is because the rules of engagement are in place. So in a place like Sweden, you have the Speaker of the House, which is maybe a touchy subject for us today in the country.
Yeah.
But the Speaker actually holds the legal coalition agreement and can sanction parties if they deviate from their agreement. That gives certainty. So no matter who's in that, there's a legal recourse if parties decide tomorrow morning they're just walking away, right? Mm. You can have an ombudsman play that role. But we need to know what the rules of the game are, and that politicians can't just do as they will. In our system at the moment, what gives us fear is because we have such a party-centered democracy, after we voted as voters, we don't feel like we can say anything to the parties afterwards. So they can just have a closed room discussion, put together a contract. We don't ever see it. And then they just go out their merry way.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff needs to change in order for us to give people a sense that the process can give us certainty, even when a pre-election coalition doesn't exist.
In that sense, I mean, you've articulately described at least my fear, right? Seen in Johannesburg, in Tshwane, in Enuguruleni, where we had a local government election. People went out to vote. And then a few months later, the arrangements that are made by politicians and political parties in chambers does not reflect the will of the people. And so I must ask the question, do we have a democracy here?
Yeah, absolutely. So the city of Johannesburg mayor is my favorite conversation in the country at the moment, because Al-Jamal being able to get a mayor, even though it has two seats in council, is more democratic than not, in a sense that it follows the rules of our democracy. And this is a rule that we must know and we must remember. When we are voting, we put in place councillors at local government level, MPL. And those MPs then decide for us who will be mayor, premier, or president. We don't vote for presidents. We don't vote for mayors. We don't vote for premiers.
Yeah.
So once we give our vote into parliament, 400 people, they amongst themselves can choose anyone to be president, right?
Yeah.
We have then given them the right to make that choice.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's important for us to have conversations with them before we give them our vote. Because we must then be able to our will for this is that when you get there, this is the way in which you should vote. Because by law, anyone who is in that chamber
could become president.
Exactly. And that's because, so if the ANC MPs, right, and this is the most dramatic version of this, but I just want to make the point. So if ANC MPs get 210 votes, and that would be a majority in parliament, right? But all of them decide they're going to use their mandate from the ANC voters to vote in Julius Malema as president or to vote in a one-seat party from the Northern Cape president. That is still the will of the voter because the voter has given it to you to now use your discretion to make the right decision when you are there. And so we must have more nuanced conversations
around the democratic process. Because
how are you going to make those voting decisions for president, for budgets, for anything, because they then have your vote in their hands?
Yeah. Because the way that we play out in the theatrics of the march towards the 29th of March, the leaders of the parties are the ones talking to us, right? So whenever I'm talking to the ANC, I'm most likely going to have Cyril Ramaphosa, although he's been quite scarce in that conversation. But if I'm talking to the EFF, it's going to be Julius Malema. If I'm talking to the Action SA, it's going to be Herman Mashaba. If it's Mzansi, Rise Mzansi, it's going to be Songhe Zozibi. So in our minds as voters, we are thinking that when we vote for EFF, I'm invariably voting for for Julius Malema to become president. But that might not be the case, given the way that our democratic process works, is what you're saying to me, that whoever you vote for is going to be determined by the members of parliament once you've given them the mandate to make those decisions on your behalf. And
absolutely.
And it might not necessarily be the person that you put your mark next to, or the face next to whose face, next to the person you thought was going to become the presidential elect. Are those horse trading conversations taking place between the political parties at the moment, do you think?
So, number one, I hope no horse trading conversations are happening. I hope that principled conversations are happening about what issues people are willing to coalesce around, and what they think is in the best interest of the voter. But I would also say that it's more important to see what the voter says before making those arrangements, to listen to what the voter says in the when we vote, before making those arrangements about how you would vote in Parliament. But also to remember that the vote for president in Parliament is a secret vote. So I could be an ANC MP and vote for the UDM. No. It's a secret vote. It's a secret ballot. So really, anything is possible. I've been saying to people, we need to know who the MPs are on those lists and who the independent candidates are, because once those 400 people go in, we are essentially electing 400 potential presidents, number one, but also we are electing the 400 people who will hold the president and the ministers to account, who the ministers and the president will have to come and account to. Those people are absolutely important.
Yeah.
The MPs are crucially important, especially when it comes to coalition politics. Because remember that coalition politics isn't only about who takes up executive roles. It's also about those debates in Parliament around passing a budget. You need to get
about
all of the partners.
The chairpersons of the portfolio committees and so forth. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so the coalitions are in Parliament as well. It's in the executive. And so we must be looking for mature politicians, politicians who are easily engaged, and politicians who will not just put their interests of their party ahead of the interests of the country. Those are the things that must be front and center in our minds as we vote. And again, the more of us vote and show up, the more we put pressure on politicians to actually be accountable to us. Because if we just sit at home, we make it easy for them to have palace politics without us,
yep,
and just make deals on our behalf without our voice.
And the fact that once the person who is a member of parliament today gets voted to become president, they effectively resign from being a member of parliament and they become the state president. And those are some of the nuances sometimes that we don't understand, and how they actually affect the running of the country, which then affects me in my house and the issues that are there. So I get you, Tessa, but is that not yet another reason why, if I'm sitting at home listening to this conversation, why I might invariably distrust the process even further?
You know, not understanding a process is, you know, will cause trepidation. But I'll say two things in response to that. And the one is very important to all of us, is that we mustn't mistrust the process of the voting process itself. There's a lot of talk in the air about, you know, our elections credible. We've run 6 national and provincial elections thus far with high levels of credibility that are at global standards. So that's the one thing that we must not mistrust. But the other thing is that we must keep. And so voter education.
Sorry, Tessa, I lost you when you said, and the key thing is
we must keep engaged as voters.
Ah.
So voter education and civic education and voter conversations must continue, and we must continue to watch, continue to pay attention, continue to engage after the election. What's crucially important is that if we have an election that produces a result with multiple actors and multiple political parties, again, that's better for us. One of the things that coalitions do, and having multiple parties even in parliament does, is it broadens your opportunity to engage, right? So you may not have access to the big politician from the big party because they're, you know, hard to access. But actually, smaller parties have more of an incentive to listen to voters. They have much greater incentive. Individual candidates, even more so, a greater incentive. And so let's lean into the idea that we have a multi-party system so that there are more people to hear our voices and so that we can inspect the process close up as often as possible. Let's lean in.
What's loud and clear as far as what you're saying now is that we can't continue to be passive players in this game. We need to first understand the rules of the game. And we can't be sitting on the sidelines. We've got to be conscious, willing, proactive, and almost a nuisance in that political game. Have we made? I'm sorry, Tess. Have we made the investment though to teach us how to understand this game and therefore how to play it? Because the full sort of gambit of our political conversation in South Africa is that, you know, I invite political party leader so and so and I ask him, what do you promise the people? And then he says this, and then I feign a little argument between me and him, and then I get a couple of ratings, and then, we've had a great political conversation. And I find that absolutely boring, if not disingenuous. Mine is, have we done enough to understand that if I vote for so-and-so, they're not necessarily going to be the president just because they've got so many votes. The MPs inside there are going to be the ones that make the decision as to who's going to be the president. And so how do I become part of making sure that whoever I want to be president under those circumstances becomes president? That's the conversation that I'm looking to have, which is what we're having right now. So thankfully, thank you for coming, Tessa. But have we made the investment to teach the rules of the game and how to play the game? What is the opportunity for the electorate and the voter? And so that it isn't so much about the political parties.
Yeah, I think that investment is starting to increase. I think particularly in civil society. Civil society has for most of our democratic era been very kind of quiet during elections. But the 1994 election had a very interesting feature, where civil society, the unions, churches, took on the work of voter education in a very short space of time. They didn't leave it up to the political parties. And so I think that is starting to increase, and that's something we need more of. But even us as families, again, the Rivonia Circle, next week we are going to be launching a voter board game that teaches you the rules of the election, but it also gives you an opportunity to learn more about some of the political parties. But so that a family can sit together and have a voter conversation around the board.
Yeah,
game. We're putting out, people need to
will
start.
You, will you come, will you come and talk more to us about that one, please, Tessa?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, yep.
We need to use social media more. I'm getting lots and lots of requests from TikTokers and Instagrammers who are young, who are saying, how do I help create election content so that I can inform people about parties or about the three ballots? And it's that kind of active citizen and owning this democracy and owning this election that I think is going to make all the difference going into the 29th of May. But the other thing that I think we've started to do more in the last 5 to 10 years is at local government level. Most people are starting to know that they can know who their councillors are and they can hold their councillors to account. We've been seeing a lot more by-elections because people actually engage their councillors now. And I think the same ethic needs to now start to apply to MPs and MPLs. We must remember and know that we have the right to engage every MP. Every MP is given a constituency budget and constituency days and a constituency office every year. Over 100 days are allocated for an MP to go into society and engage us as citizens and voters. They get given budget for it. So we have the right and they have the responsibility to engage with voters. And so we must start treating them like ward councillors, all 400 of them. in that parliament.
Yeah.
We must start treating the president and the ministers as public servants that have to respond to us. We must not be passive anymore. The politics is not for a few people who decide to be politicians. Politics is for all of us to hire people to work for us to be political activists. And that's the final thing I wanted to say about that, is that we must expect from politicians to come and ask us for a job and then tell us how they're going to do it and commit to us when they're going to report back. They must be activists in the state on our behalf. And that's the kind of conversation we should be having with politicians when we engage them, with people knocking at our doors during door-to-doors, with them on social media, not only before the election, but after the election. It is imperative that we have a different conversation with politicians about, all right, now that you're in government, you represent all of us. Tell us what you're doing. Yeah. What did you do yesterday?
Yeah. Here's a question from Amos Sheb. He says, please ask your guest to explain her view of maturity level of the politicians with regards to coalition?
Oh, that's a very difficult question.
And you know what? I can tell you right now that whatever you answer, you're going to get into trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Whatever your answer is, you are going to get into trouble. All right. So, and what I'm worried about, Tessa, is that that has now become the characteristic of the political conversation in this country. That yeah. we can't have conversations without being set up for failure. That's why I'm not the best one to speak to politicians, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you say, what question you ask. There's going to be a fight. There's going to be that you can't ask a question for objectivity's sake. So, you know, right. I don't know how you can answer that question, but there it is.
So we must also ask ourselves, you know, what it is that we think of as maturity, right? So politicians have in South Africa, but in many places in the world, have gotten it into their minds that if they are extreme and loud and flamboyant, that's what voters want. And that's because that's what the media wants.
Yep.
The media is attracted to the spectacle. And so the politicians put on the spectacle to yep. get the eyes of the media on them
yep.
so they can be transmitted to the voter.
Yep.
But really, if we know ourselves as voters, most of us don't tend towards extremes. Most of us, if we're in our house by ourselves, are not thinking about extremes and saying, you know, let's do this extreme difference, let's do that extreme difference. I said earlier, people don't like uncertainty. Extremes actually freak most of us out. And so for me, when we think about the maturity of politicians, do we trust that the politicians will go in there and be able to reach compromises that make sense and not be so married to extreme positions that they cannot find a middle ground to move forward on? And so, you know, for me, the big thing about coalitions is going to be, can we have coalitions that are based on basic things everybody can agree on? That's really what we're looking for. And as the voter, we must encourage politicians to tell us practical, workable things rather than excitable things. Yes, 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 that was very nice. We were excited. We clapped. Yep. Now tell me the detail of how we're going to do it practically. Be practical with me and be practical in those engagements in coalitions. I think we have created a political culture.
No, I couldn't agree with you about the
practical.
I couldn't agree with you more about the spectacle that has been created largely by the media. I couldn't agree with you more. Let's talk to Mlungi, talk about Mlungisi, who sends me another message. Mlungisi says, but Aubrey, I'm concerned about the independent candidates. I've not come across a single one. I wish they could do more with less to make themselves visible. Something like a 10-minute social media video on experience and intentions would compel me to vote independent, says Mlungisi. And again, I suppose access to not only independent candidates, but yeah, in this case, the caller is talking about independent candidates. How do we get them to start speaking to the electorate?
Yeah. So, I mean, every independent candidate, there are only 16 in this election, by the way. There were over 1,000 in the local government elections, but only 16 in the national and provincial. But they are speaking to voters. They just don't have a far enough reach. So they are curating, you know, because also the independents can only contest one province at a time. So they can't speak. So if Zaki Ahmed or last week I heard about Blessing, I think his name is Mokwena, they can speak in Limpopo or Western Cape because they have to get that particular group of voters because they'll be on a regional ballot. So they have to be very tight about who they engage. So just having a national audience, you're in Western Cape, but somebody in Gauteng wants to vote for you, you're not going to be on that ballot. So they are having to keep it quite localized. But I do think that the media has a role to play in elevating the voices of independent candidates and the smaller parties. So there's like a weird logic that we have in the media, that the more power and resources you have, the more media attention we'll give you.
Yeah.
It's illogical.
Yeah. Yep.
The ANC doesn't have it. It's the smaller parties, it's the independent candidates who don't have the money who need the free media. Yeah. And so if we want to have an equitable, fair election, the public needs to get involved, the media needs to get involved, civil society needs to get involved.
Yeah.
And presenting them to the electorate as much as possible. That's unfortunately the best way that we're going to do it.
Jessa, we've run out of time. How do people get in touch with you? Let me quickly read you this. Steve says, "You got a brilliant guest in studio, Bra Obs. I learned so much from her tonight. I always learn a lot from your shows." And then Sanji says, Tessa has told us nothing new."
I've been saying the same thing for 3 months now. I'm exhausted. Yay.
Tessa, how do people get in touch with you?
So I'm on all social media platforms as Tessa Dooms, but also you can follow our work. At the Rivonia Circle, we're doing voter conversation work, and we are doing kind of voter education work on the process, especially the changes in the selection, the independence, three ballots, all of that. So you can find us on Rivonia Circle on all social media platforms or Tessa Dooms, and I'll be speaking about elections every day until they happen.
Looking to hear a little bit more about that game.